You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Toan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Today I'm going to read for you the first six chapters of my manuscript, Nighttime Daydreams, coincidentally the same name as the radio show you're listening to. The chapters are Portrait of the Artist as a Mad Teen, number 2, Soul Vine, number 3, Anything Out of the Ordinary, number 4, Mother and Son, number 5, The Talking Cure, and number 6, Nezahualcoyotl's Speech on Mysticism. This rainforest of a book contains poetry, essay, adventure story, autobiography, journalism, travel literature, intercultural communication studies, linguistics, ecology, ethnobotany, and mythology. It's much too long, and some of it needs to be cut, but not from the beginning. You'll also hear some of what I loosely call music. The first thing you heard on the show was me on nose flute, and later you'll hear me on Amazon jungle style one-string musical bow, and then Koxian, K-O-U-X-I-A-N. So, let's rock it. Preface: this book is designed as a rainforest of language, orderly, chaotic, groaning with death, humming with life. Its literary flourishes are foliage through which visions leap like monkeys, sometimes pausing to stare out at the reader with live eyes. Trigger warning: contains sex, drugs, violence, mental illness, and sensitive poetry. Chapter 1, Portrait of the Artist as a Mad Teen. Guy, go. I chant as I shuffle through 4 inches of snow atop this frozen lake. The left foot is Guy and the right foot is Go. Guy, go, Guy, go. It's an acronym from computing I heard recently. Garbage in, garbage out. The quality of the input determines the quality of the output. This explains my life. I glance across the lake, daring the universe to answer, what can be expected of me? I'm drawing a giant spiral of Geigo on the surface of the lake with my shuffling feet. It's a performance art piece, and a signal for help to whatever god or gods might be watching. As I suck the freezing air into my lungs, I try to stare into the future as the seers of old were said to have done. I feel the closeness of the spirit world, but I can't quite reach it. At 17, I'm the most intelligent and most fucked up person in the world. I want to fly up and dissolve in the cold wind that glides without thinking above the frozen land. My body cannot support the transformations I wish to undergo. Thus, I would like to die. To die. That's what Elena wanted, or didn't want. She's with her family in Miami now. In the middle of the night, she stood in her shower with a razor blade, tested it on her wrist, thought about cutting into herself, finally decided to get out of the shower instead, phoned her parents, went home, got some mental health care, leaving me without her mad mind that matched my own. Every time I go deep inside myself, all I feel is pain. It's the central truth of who I am. If I were different, I could get it out by hurting people, punching someone, joining the military, and killing people in foreign lands. I imagine getting a pistol and shooting my classmates. Each bullet that left the barrel would pull one nail out of my heart, but that wouldn't help at all. Every time I've hurt someone, I've ended up feeling worse than them. I'm ashamed of my potential for violence. So in the end, I'm left with no one to harm but myself. I think again about jumping off the balcony in my dormitory and breaking my leg. The pain would give my mind some clarity. Or shooting myself in the forehead. One blast, and all the thoughts would be gone. I'm sure that if I survive into adulthood, I'll be a great poet. All the signs are present. The words of the poets who came before me buzz around my head like helicopters. I can turn a phrase, turn it round, make it dissolve in a shower of sparks, or pet it so it purrs. Here in northern Michigan, at this boarding school dedicated to the arts, I study creative writing. I'm no good at fiction. I can't imagine plots or characters. But I can take a thought and coat it with words and let that dry and peel it off, and that's a poem. Our poetry teacher tells me that by the time I'm 21, I'll be publishing in the best journals in the country. And despite my psychological problems, for the first time I'm one of the popular kids. Some of the females even wish to explore their sexualities with me. Maybe because at close range I give off an intoxicating pheromone of mad genius. Maybe they'd like to be able to say many decades later I made out with that great poet when he was a crazy young man. Or maybe they just like me. It's hard for me to see why they would, though. Since I was 13, I've had obsessive ideations of sex and violence, like the Saad does Auschwitz. All the horrors the human mind can imagine made their home inside my head. I didn't ask for these visions. I don't want them. I can't puke them out. I can't swat them away. They live up under my roof like a nest of flies. Over time, I've almost gotten used to their buzzing. I fear they might even be the real me. They would like me to hurt people. They promise the twisted joy of cruelty. I think they must be the spawn of the rage and jealousy I feel toward normal people, happy people, sleeping, stupid people, people whose souls weren't ripped in half when they were three. I box with shadows, and the shadows win. So am I going to end up another Charles Manson, another Jack the Ripper? I'd rather die. I resolve as I geigo my shuffling way forward, imagining my tall, gangly body lying in a coffin, dressed in a suit. My dad is supported by his brother and sister. My mom is weeping uncontrollably. Womb to tomb, I think. Garbage in, garbage out. What gets me through the day? Literature and lovemaking. The first time Elena and I made love, I couldn't believe anyone had ever enjoyed it as much as we had. If it was this good, I wondered in the afterglow, why and how would anyone do anything else? As we lay there holding each other, we felt that we had invented sex. But most days, I feel like screaming. I reach the center of my spiral. I pull off my mittens, jam them in the pockets of my down jacket. I reach both hands to the sky, stare up at the winking stars, await the spiritual experience that I know won't come. When it doesn't, and when I'm done feeling the cold air whip across my hands, I quietly retrace my spiraling steps and head for the dorm. My boot treads trickle snowmelt on the doormat. I'm perched on the edge of my bed. My cheeks are flushed, my toes cold. The only sound, the Black Flag song on my roommate Hank Brubaker's stereo. Guitar, bass, drums, an incoherent shouting voice. Then Brubaker starts saying to me, "The fuck are you talking about? She didn't want to kill herself. If she had, she would have done it instead of just talking about it. Speaking of talking, Nat, you're pretty good at talking. Why don't you talk some sense into your head?" Quarrelsome, haughty, sad, pissed off, convinced I'm right, I choke out, "Everything I've heard about people who commit suicide says that they sometimes do talk about it. So if anyone ever says they're contemplating suicide, you should take that really seriously. I'll tell you right now, I'm thinking of killing myself, and the fact that I'm telling you is no guarantee that I won't." Brubaker barks, "That's bullshit, and you fucking know it. Nat, man, I know your parents have you convinced you're a genius. You're their only child, I get that. But if you are, then you're the dumbest goddamn genius I've ever met." I stalk into the bathroom, fill an empty Sprite can from the tap, take a bottle of aspirin out of the medicine chest behind the mirror, plunk back down on my bed, unscrew the childproof cap, pluck out the cotton, shake a white tablet onto the moist palm of my left hand. I'm gonna fucking end this right now. Brubaker watches me gulp the first pill with a swig of water, then the second, then the third. But ultimately, he's right. I don't quite want to die. After number 20, I smack the can and the bottle on my desk and tell Brubaker, "Now go get whoever's on duty. They need to drive me to the hospital. Go." A doctor gives me a hospital gown, a bottle labeled syrup of ipecac, and a huge steel bowl to vomit in. When it's over, I look up at the doctor and our eyes meet. He seems to see some value in me that I don't see in myself, and with his eyes, he asks me not to do anything like this again. At the same time, he looks as if he'd love to beat the hell out of whatever is harming me, if only he knew how. Chapter 2, Soul Vine. 20 aspirins had been the sweet spot. On the one hand, it wasn't enough to cause me any permanent damage, at least if I got treated as soon as possible. And on the other hand, it was enough to convince my friend Brubaker that I was serious, whatever the fuck it was I was up to. I was sent home and spent 3 weeks in therapy. When I got back to the academy, everyone, including Brubaker, was kind to me. I had expressed the desperation my friends felt, too, for the various reasons. We had all died and been reborn a little. My friends were also just happy I hadn't actually killed myself. In a book in the school library, I read about a psychedelic potion used in shamanic ceremonies in the Amazon jungle, ayahuasca. Its name meant vine of the soul, vine of the dead, vine of the spirits. This recalled the Carlos Castaneda books that had enchanted me in junior high, factually suspect but vivid accounts of a sorcerer's apprenticeship in Mexico. They made more sense to me than either science or religion did. At an age when my classmates were getting bar mitzvahs or playing football, I conceived an ambition to eat peyote with a medicine man and perceive alternate realities. At 16, I dropped acid. It fascinated, but the context felt wrong. I didn't want to go out of my mind in the city. Now I wondered if the jungle might be the right place, though it seemed impossibly far away. I read that people who drank the soul vine vomited and saw kaleidoscope designs and snakes and jaguars. The spirit of the potion was supposed to be a rainbow-colored serpent. I thought the soul vine might be able to help me. Puking with the syrup of ipecac had purged me of a tiny fraction of the psychological garbage I'd been carrying around. I imagined I could have gotten rid of more if I'd been tripping at the same time, especially with the help of a friendly spirit in whose existence I wanted to believe. I read up on shamans. They could send their souls outside their bodies. Poetry had originated in their magical speech. Sometimes they fought with spells. They could see inside sick people's bodies and pull sickness out with their hands, or even suck it out with their mouths. Because I found it hard to believe in anything, I wondered how shamans could convince themselves of these experiences. Much of my own mental activity was directed at interrogating reality. I wondered, why did we come here? Where were we before we were conceived? Where do we go when we die? What are good and evil? How can we be good? The geopolitical atrocities of the 20th century had bled into my mind, and the scenarios unfolded in concentration camps and Vietnamese jungles in my head. Why is society so messed up? What's our role in it, in living in it, and potentially improving it? Can we stop destroying the earth? Do indigenous people know anything that can help the rest of us? What do they mean when they talk about nature spirits? Is there one God, or many, or none? Does it matter? All my wondering exhausted me. A few of my pot experiences had been strong enough to temporarily shut down my questioning. That had been a huge relief. Maybe ayahuasca could help me rest my mind by letting me believe in something, even if only for a while. I read about a common way someone would enter the shaman profession. A kid is sick for a long time. A diagnosis, by a shaman to be sure, finds that the illness is caused by spirits who will cure the kid if he or she becomes a shaman. The parents promise to raise the child to be a shaman, and the illness passes. My gaze flickered up from the book through a floor-to-ceiling window at a grove of pines. Under the churning gray sky, the snow on the branches looked like Italian marble. Maybe I'd found my problem. Maybe I was getting worked over by spirits that would quit harassing me if I learned to work with them. Maybe I could go to a shaman and be healed and become a shaman myself. But as I lay in bed that night, I knew that was just a fantasy. Realistically, I would probably be a writer in New York. I also imagined I could pilot a single-engine plane smuggling pot out of Colombia into the United States. That was just a private joke, though. It sounded fun, but it wasn't something I'd really do. In junior high, I'd taken a standardized career test that found I was suited to be a museum curator. Sure, why not? The Natural History Museum in my hometown was an interdimensional gateway to other times and places. It often showed up in my dreams with strange architectures and exhibits. The thought of working in an office from 9 to 5 gave me chest pain. The other thing I absolutely didn't want to do was teach at universities, like my parents and my stepfather did. I thought about the cold wind slipping over the dormitory in darkness, and soon I was asleep. Chapter 3, Anything Out of the Ordinary. I followed the rump of Jennifer's blue jeans with my eyes until she went out the door of Kosher Co-op. She'd broken up with me 2 weeks before, but we were still friends. This meant we usually had lunch together, and I tried to get her back into bed. That never worked. I contemplated the object on the table in front of me, a National Geographic magazine displaying a photo of a lionfish in dark water, its barbed, quill-like, rainbow-colored fins fanning out around its baleful face. I was in my last semester at an elite liberal arts college in Ohio. To disguise its identity, let's call it Berlino. For 4 years, I had nourished myself on great works of literature, Canterbury Tales, Ulysses, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. While pacing up and down in what felt like an expensive cage, I'd been guided by my mom to a highly rated private institution, toward graduate school and an academic career. As the semesters rolled by, I still didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out. I didn't want to go for a PhD. I was afraid of ending up in a life that wouldn't be authentically mine. I loved my girlfriends, one after another, but I couldn't dedicate myself to any of them. I felt like nature was trying to say something to me, or the spirits were, but there was too much noise in my life to hear. I loved literature, but I didn't want to be only a reader and a writer. I wanted to be a character in my own adventure story. That didn't seem to be an option, though. So I traveled in books. There were spaceships, time machines, multipliers of identity. Unlike those at the Arts Academy, my writing teachers here were unanimously unimpressed with my poetry and turned off by my inflated opinion of it. In turn, I pitied them for not being as successful as I was sure I would be at their age. I kept writing poetry, but stopped showing it to them. It had become something I did reflexively, like nail biting, foot tapping, and certain other things that young people do. Sometimes I wrote out of joy, too, and then it was like tattooing the skin of the earth with lightning. Keeping the unspoken promise I'd made to the doctor, I no longer considered killing myself, but I had lower back pain every waking hour. I was sure there was nothing wrong with me physically, except what was wrong with me mentally. Emotional garbage stored in my body from my parents' divorce and their 2.5-year custody battle over me. So I knew what it was, but I couldn't get rid of it, and its putrescent vapors gave me waking nightmares. In my first semester of college, I had tried to redeem myself by giving some rein to my dark impulses. After all, they were natural, atavistic. The key was to channel them into something positive, love. Her eyes downcast, Colette stepped into my mind, playing her silver flute. Even after 4 years, my cheeks flushed. I observed an oil stain on the opposite wall where I'd thrown a fried chicken thigh during a food fight with the rabbi a week earlier. The stocky, balding chaplain had fought well, despite being almost 100% blind. After I missed him with the chicken thigh, he charged after me, roaring with a boiled potato. I had to interpose a plastic trash barrel between us to get a second to jump away from him, enough to pivot and bean him on the head with half an orange before leaping backwards again to avoid a rabbinical potato-handed swipe to the face. At 4 o'clock, from the oil stain on the wall, a stranger was gesturing broadly as he conversed with friends of mine. He seemed to know them, so he had probably graduated and was visiting. Although it was warm in the co-op, he wore a brightly colored Andean knit cap with ear flaps and tassels. My 9 o'clock class that day had been Archaeology of the Ancient Maya. The professor had discussed the Popol Vuh, the holy book of the K'iche' Maya. "They called the book an instrument of seeing," she said. "It presented mythology that transported them to primordial times, but equally it was part of their divination system. It gave them information beyond what their senses could ordinarily know. In that sense, it allowed them to approach the condition of their all-seeing ancestors, because according to K'iche' myth, the gods created the first four men with senses that were infinite. They could see, hear, smell, taste, and feel everything in the world at once. Soon the gods decided that these beings were too powerful, and they limited the men's senses to what we have now. But they gave them two powerful gifts to make up for it. Women and books, instruments of seeing." I looked back at the oil stain on the wall. It was an asymmetrical Rorschach blot, another instrument for seeing. It didn't look like a book, though, more like an island or a dolphin. My surrealism professor taught that the French poet Arthur Rimbaud had recommended visualizing images and random forms in the environment. One must become a seer, Rambo added, through a systematic derangement of all the senses. Maybe the dolphin and the island are symbols of my future, I thought. I'd like to move to an island and swim with dolphins. But when I graduate, I'm just going to go home and move back in with my mom and stepdad, get a meaningless job, systematically derange my senses, and plan my next move. Maybe I'll teach English in Japan. Anything to get out of the United States. I made eye contact with the lionfish. I'd brought the magazine to help explain psychedelics to my friend Ben, who disapproved of them, without, I felt, knowing enough about them. But he hadn't shown up to lunch. A month earlier, I had picked up this issue, October 1990, from my mailbox while on mushrooms. When I emerge into the sunlight, the central quadrangle of the college is filled with soft, transparent spheres. I curl up with a magazine in a big wrought iron chair and marvel at the lionfish. The cover article is on a deep ocean ecosystem next to Tokyo called Suruga Bay. The Pacific gets very deep there, very fast. The next article is on a tribe in Mali called the Dogon. Their shamans practice divination by tracing a chart in the sand, baiting it with peanuts, and reading it the following morning after a desert fox has stepped in certain segments of it to nosh the peanuts. I'm charmed. I'm enchanted. I wish I knew how to do that. I stage whisper to the glossy air, "How can you not eat mushrooms in a world where fish have poison rainbows and fox footsteps tell the future?" But now, when I tried to summon that shroomy delight, it wouldn't come. The lionfish seemed to shrug. I stared up at the fried chicken stain again, that island-shaped instrument of seeing and remembering, and replayed the tones of the conversation I had just had with Jennifer. I had been all seriousness and heaviness. She, lightness, bubbliness, moist lips curving up in a smile that made me desperate to kiss her again. What if we were in a shipwreck and we washed up on an island, and then we were all alone on this island for years? Then she would, wouldn't she? My good friend Mark Horowitz, presumably a distant cousin of mine, he's from the Hungarian branch of the family, stopped petting his brown goatee, leaned over to me, and said crisply, "Horowitz, get your brain down off the wall a second. See that guy over there?" He indicated the stranger with the multicolored cap. "You should talk to him. His name's Jeremy Carver. You know how you're all into the Amazon jungle. He graduated 2 years ago, and he just got back from a year in South America." "Cool." By way of a greeting, I scooped up 4 peas on my spoon and catapulted them onto the table in front of the stranger, where they bounced and rolled. My contribution was noticed, but not reacted to. Soon the conversation partners dispersed. I had an hour before my next class, so I stood up cautiously. My lower back felt like a turkey fork was stuck into it, and went over and introduced myself to the visitor. "I'm really interested in South America, especially in the shamanism there, if you know anything about it," I said. "Could you tell me about your trip?" "Sure thing," he said. "Have a seat." He took a swig of black coffee. "I spent a lot of time in the jungle in Ecuador. I met some of the shamans. These days they're accepting outsiders as apprentices because the young people in the communities don't want to learn the old traditions anymore. I got off a bus in a jungle town and met this shaman called Nenke from the Waurani tribe. The Waranis are semi-wild. They've only had contact with outsiders for like 30 years. So Nenke was waiting there for me at the bus station. He said he knew I was coming." "Wow." "Yeah, he took me by the hand and brought me into the forest and taught me things about nature and the spirit world." "Your Spanish must be really good." "It isn't. His isn't either. It's hard to explain this. He taught me without speaking, like telepathically. For instance, he told me that every human has 2 spirit eyes in the chest, midway between the nipples and the collarbones. You can use them to see energy. And spirits can come into you through the palm of your left hand and go out through the palm of your right hand. He was willing to keep teaching me, and I thought about accepting his offer, but I didn't want to live there." "Why not?" "I'm going into grad school in music. I play jazz saxophone. So when I went back to Quito, after being with Nenke and the Waranis, I was at a youth hostel, and this young shaman from another tribe called the Quichuas came to stay there. That night, all night, I was in this half-dream, half-waking trance where I was being attacked by anacondas. They were streaming toward me in the air. I couldn't stop them. I couldn't fight with them. The only thing I could do was dance with them. I redirected them away with my hands, like this. They kept coming. I kept shifting them away. In the morning at breakfast, everyone in the hotel I talked to said they had dreamed of being attacked by boas. Later that day, the shaman admitted that he'd tried to steal energy from everybody. He said his people had lost their land and he was trying to gather energy to support them. It was a hunting expedition for power. Whoa. Yeah, so since I've been back in the States, I keep dreaming of Waranis. It feels like the tribe is learning more about me by projecting themselves into my mind. For real. One time when I was down there, I had a dream I was a jaguar. I was running through a clearing in the forest. I could sense everything like a jaguar would sense it. The vision, the hearing, the smell, the taste in my mouth, the feel of my jaguar body, the weight of it, the power, the speed, the sensation of my paws whamming into the ground and springing forward off it. I ran a long way as a jaguar before I woke up. Did you ever try ayahuasca? No. It was around. I knew some people who did. I never needed it. I felt like I was tripping the whole time I was there. But some of the shamans drink it, and some of them share it with outsiders. Jeremy, what you've just told me is more interesting than anything I've heard in 4 years of college. He nodded, and the multicolored tassels of his wool cap shook. You should check out Ecuador, man. Chapter 4, Mother and Son. Nobody would think you were weird if you went back to school, got married, and found a good job. You like literature and you're good at it. You could teach that stuff at a university. I felt again that sensation like getting punched in the stomach. I wanted to yell at her, but I knew if I did, I would start to cry. I spoke as evenly as I could. I can't do that. I clenched my teeth and stuck my hands deeper into my jacket pockets. The Newfoundland dog's toenails clicked on the damp sidewalk to the rhythm of the sway of her midsection and hips. She stopped to snuffle the base of a forsythia bush covered in tight green buds. We stopped too. From high in an elm tree, a songbird belted out a sharp melody. My mom would know the species name. I didn't care. I wanted to get to the point where the bird could tell me its own name for itself. The shamans knew how to do this. I revisited something that had happened a week after I'd met Jeremy Carver. On a cold autumn day, I smoked pot and sat on the steps of Kosher Co-op. In the blue sky, a la Rimbaud, a white cloud looming over the campus took on the precise shape of the beautiful clownish skeleton of a bottlenosed dolphin grinning down at me with dozens of conical teeth. Simultaneously, I became captivated by an idea that seemed more and more evident the more I thought about it. The idea went like this. Around the time I was conceived, some shamans, whose practices were threatened by missionary activity, were conducting an ayahuasca ceremony. As they lay in the hammocks, in the darkness of a ceremonial hut, one or more of them sent something out, a wish, a prayer, an impulse, an atom of consciousness, that floated through the world like a cool blue spark, traveling, wandering, until it met my inchoate soul, which was just beginning to assemble itself. And which welcomed it in. The wish was that someone born outside the forest would take up the work of the shamans, which was necessary to support life on Earth. I wondered how many others they had sent out. Apart from being a logical response by shamans to the threat to their practice, the idea explained why I had always felt at odds with society and drawn to the wilderness. But I knew I wouldn't be able to sell the idea to my mom. And I knew, too, that it was likely to be just one of those things that one thinks of while high on pot. I'd have to speak of acquiring valuable non-Western and pre-modern knowledge. As an academic, as an intellectual, she should accept that. But as usual, as soon as I opened my mouth, I deflated. I want to go to the jungle and study shamanism. I muttered, glancing at an oak tree for support. I think the indigenous people know things that we've lost about nature and the spirit world and healing. If they know so much about healing, why is the child mortality rate so high in the third world? She shot back. I couldn't answer. And you're always talking about the spirit world. People want to believe in something because they're afraid of dying. In the Western world, we've been working since the Enlightenment to get rid of superstitions and see things the way they really are. You should read the existentialists, as I keep telling you. Read Sartre and Camus. Then you wouldn't want to clutter up your head with crazy cosmologies from Cloud Cuckoo Land. That drug you told me the Indians take, Ayahuasca doozy or whatever it is. You want to know what tripping does to people? I'll take you to a mental hospital sometime, and you can look at some of those people drooling in the back ward. Nathaniel, I spent far too much time and energy raising you to want to lose you to drugs. I don't think tripping can make someone crazy just like that, I said. I didn't sound convinced. The thought crossed my mind again that maybe I was one of those people who shouldn't take hallucinogens because they're already unstable. My mom went on. The other day I talked to a colleague of mine who researches brain chemistry at the university. We stopped at a corner to let a car go by. Drugs like LSD damage people's genes and fry their brains. She looked me in the eye, daring me to respond. Under her gray hair, her Celtic face was stormy, her blue eyes fierce. The dog swung her own worried face around to glance at us, then turned back and sniffed the breeze blowing down the street. I couldn't think of anything to say. Maybe my brain really was fried. I graduated a few months earlier, in December, and moved back in with my mom and stepdad in Ann Arbor. A month after that, I'd read a letter, wept, kicked a hole in my bedroom door, and mailed Jennifer a check for $370 to pay for an abortion, without knowing whether to believe her claim that she had been pregnant. Maybe it was my heart that was fried. We crossed the street in silence and entered the park. The gray sky sagged like a dirty sheet. A three-story brick box with windows came into view, my old elementary school. The breeze blew the aluminum pulley against the aluminum flagpole with a sad clank that I remembered from childhood. I wished my mom would walk home alone so I could let the dog off the leash and climb the hill. "I'll tell you what," she said. "I think there might be things you could talk about with a therapist. If you want, I'll call around and make an appointment for you. If you find someone you like, you can work with them." I considered this. It would be good to unload my problems on someone, and it would get my mom off my back for a while. As I opened my mouth to agree to her offer, a coughing fit doubled me over. When I straightened up, her furious eyes pierced me. "Are you smoking dope again?" Yes, I would have a lot to talk about with a therapist. Chapter 5, The Talking Cure. When I was 6, my dad took me to a Scottish festival. Huge guys were competing to see who could throw an iron ball on a chain the farthest. When it was over and the crowd went away, my dad went over and picked up the chain, and he couldn't even lift the ball off the ground. I was like, "Oh, shit, my dad is weak." "Is there anyone in your family who's strong?" "My mom's brother, Pat. He was 6'4". In high school, he once played the last quarter of a football game with a broken leg. Later, he was a paratrooper in the army. He was the strong guy in my family. I wish my dad was more like him. He was the strong guy? He died when I was 10. That totally messed up my mom. She loved him like nobody else. I choked up and tears ran down my cheeks. Dr. Seligman was used to my tears. He handed me a box of Kleenex and looked out the window as I blew my nose and threw the tissue into the round, gold-colored wastebasket. He continued, "So you didn't see your father as a strong person. What is he good at?" "He teaches art at a community college. All the time I was ashamed of how weak he was dragging me through art museums. I hated it, but I have to admit he taught me some stuff about art. When I was 13, he told my friends and me about European art movements. We all wanted to be Dadaists and Surrealists. Decode society, expose it, make it more authentic, burn off the stupidity. Épater la bourgeoisie, that was our slogan. Freak normal people out." "Okay, what about your mother?" "A lot of the time we're like best friends. She's really funny. She taught me to read and write and be into books. But she wants to run my life, and it's hard to have any secrets from her. I feel like she can read my mind even when she's not around. That's part of why I smoke pot. It creates this mental space she can't break into." "Mm-hmm." "The ironic thing about my mom not believing in psychic experiences is that she herself had an amazing one the night her brother Pat died. I had a hockey coach who always reminded her of him. So she has this dream that my coach is dying on an operating table. Doctors are trying to save his life, but it's not working. And she's crying really hard. And suddenly she wakes up with the sound of a crash echoing in her ears. She looks at the digital clock on the bedside table. 4:17 a.m. She goes back to sleep. 2 hours later, the phone rings. It's her sister Anne sobbing into the phone. "Pat's dead. Pat's dead." He'd been out late at a union meeting. He'd had a few beers, and on the way home, he totaled his car and his body. He died on an operating table at exactly 4:17 a.m. Now, am I crazy to think that's interesting? No. I don't want to go directly to the Amazon. I want to go to Mexico first, check out peyote and Mexican shamanism, and finish getting fluent in Spanish, then head down to Ecuador and study with the shaman who drinks ayahuasca. That was my plan. I was secretly afraid that I would blurt out twisted sexual fantasies on these hallucinogens, or go irrevocably insane, as my mom said, but I was more afraid of doing nothing. I went on. I think I could be healed that way and maybe help other people too. I secretly hoped the Indians would recognize my aptitude for magic and make me their leader, and we would mount a guerrilla campaign against deforestation, oil companies, and the desacralization of nature. I had my literary dream too. I concluded, I want to take notes in a journal and then write a book. I stared at the wall, imagining reviews. A delusion wrapped in a fairy tale. Even more than psychedelics, the author is addicted to far-fetched ideas, his own and other people's. Full of anti-scientism and bong philosophy, this book should have been titled Gullible Travels. Incredibly tiresome, like meeting someone at a party who has to tell you every last detail of an acid trip. A coherent vision of the world that synthesizes archaic and contemporary thought. A coming-of-age story, a record of encounters with cultures and nature, a diary of mystical experiences. It's like Kerouac meets Castaneda in the rainforest. Burn it and behead the author. A sad reflection on the strength of education today when kids perceive this trite Jewish shit to be anything close to actual literature. A magical story, enchantingly told. It has no narrative drive. A focused and sustained attempt to understand shamanism on its own terms, on its own turf. The unreliable narrative of an unreliable narrator. People like us need books like this. Controversial and superbly written. Like the rainbow serpent, it's intensely colored and seems alive, and while you're in it, it's hard to see the shape of the whole thing because the narrative keeps pausing on scenes that invite reflection. It's the beauty that keeps me turning pages, not the plot. It was mesmerizing, hypnotic. I will read it again and again. It was mesmerizing, hypnotic. I will read it again and again. It was mesmerizing, hypnotic. I will read it again and again. Every time I meet a woman, I go through this whole cycle of, "You're so beautiful. You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. I could love you for the rest of my life." And then we get involved, and after a while, it doesn't work, because I have no idea how to be in a romantic relationship. But I stay in it because we're having sex. And every time I'm around her, that's all I want to do, instead of like talking or walking around. We end up hating each other and she breaks up with me, and a month later I meet another woman and it begins again. That sounds bleak. Is it really that bad all the time? No, it's amazing too. We always learn from each other and from being together. I nibbled my lower lip, remembering nibbling other people's lower lips. I have this idea that I should try out as many women as possible. And if there's one of them who I still have something to talk about with after we've had sex a bunch of times, that's who I should marry. See, I think my parents got married too early, before either of them had played around enough, and that caused problems in their marriage. I don't want to make that mistake, and that's why I don't stay single for long. There's usually someone else nice around, I concluded with a smile. Can you think of a couple of dreams you've had that characterize what's on your mind these days? Just whatever pops into your head. Interesting question, I thought. There's so many of them. The one where I rode a dead dolphin through the air in a deserted hospital? No, the Jaguar one, because of Jeremy. Well, I've been thinking about what Jeremy Carver said recently, and it reminds me of this dream I had when I was 15. A nuclear war wipes out almost all of humanity. I'm walking through these wrecked streets in some American city, and I see the dead body of this drug dealer I know just lying across the sidewalk. And I think, I wonder what's in his pockets. I go through the pockets of his jeans. The only thing I find is this light blue pill, which I know is mescaline because in the dream I've seen these pills before. So I swallow the pill and keep on walking. By the way, I'd never tripped in real life at this point, but I was planning to when I could. Anyway, I'm walking and these two Jaguars walked out of a deserted store and come toward me. It's a male and a female, brother and sister. Without talking to me, but telepathically, they tell me to have sex with the female. And I'm like, what? No way. The two of them rush me and claw my thighs, basically saying that they'll kill me if I don't. So I follow them inside. She lies on her back. I get on top of her, and then I woke up. I don't know what it means. What's the earliest association with wild cats that you can remember? Well, I played the Cowardly Lion in a stage production of The Wizard of Oz at my kindergarten. That role was perfect for me. I was big, but I was always getting beaten up by other kids. Anybody who wanted to could come up and take a swing at me. I'd get weak and I couldn't fight back. But the lion goes off searching for the wizard who can give him some courage. And at the end of the play, I drank a bottle of Red Pop and got my courage and roared. My mom made me a lion costume out of orange-brown felt. I kept it in my closet for years. Huh, sounds like you were a closet lion. Okay, another dream. Okay, this is really fucked up. Last month, I dreamed I was writing down ideas for poems. I blacked out for a little while, and when I came to, there was another line written in the notebook in a different handwriting. It said, I'm inside you now. I woke up in this crazy panic, afraid I was going to hurt somebody. And what does that say to you? That there's some outside energy in me that I've got to get out before I really do hurt someone. You believe that? I don't disbelieve it. Without wanting to deny the validity of what you're saying, I would caution you against ascribing too much authority to a single image from a dream. People dream about all kinds of things, some of them pretty scary. Okay, so tamp it down, maybe give me some medication and count the months before I end up in jail or a mental institution or dead. I glared at Dr. Seligman, who regarded me calmly, then smiled. You know, you looked almost like a warrior when you said that. You looked like you were about ready to take up arms and fight against whatever it is that's bothering you. He paused. You keep talking about how you want to study shamanism. I can't think of a single reason why you shouldn't. If that's something you really feel you need to do, don't waste any more time around here. You were listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Tawan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. In this hour, I'm reading from my unfinished manuscript called Nighttime Daydreams. It's a gringo's story of trying to learn how to be a shaman. And this is Chapter 6, Nezahualcoyotl's speech on mysticism. Soon after Dr. Seligman gave me the green light, an Aztec shaman materialized in Ann Arbor and gave me some language for thinking about these matters. Nezahualcoyotl was from Mexico City, and he'd been invited to speak at a university seminar on mysticism hosted by the religion department. He was short, even for a Mexican, in his early 70s, with umber skin, a salt and pepper goatee, a melodious voice, and eyes like interstellar voids. Introducing him, one of the organizers said he and 10 of his students had been the first Mexicans who took part in the sun dance of the Lakota Sioux tribe in North Dakota, and he had later been given permission to put on sun dances of his own. The name Nezahualcoyotl meant fasting coyote in Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs. The original bearer of that name had been a king in pre-Columbian Mexico. The current man had been given the name by the Council of Anahuac, a group formerly clandestine, now out in the open, that had kept Aztec culture alive during the centuries of foreign occupation by the Spanish. And the sun dance, I'd run across that in my readings. It was banned for decades by the U.S. government for being pagan and seditious, then legalized in the 1970s. For 4 days, the dancers fast from food and water and dance in a circle under the hot sun around a tree representing the axis of the world. They dedicate their energy and their suffering to the sun to thank the Great Spirit for warming and lighting up the world. They may undergo a further sacrifice, allowing their chests to be pierced and themselves to be hoisted up off the ground to hang there by the piercings. The rationale for doing this is basically incomprehensible to most Western minds. I clicked the tape recorder on. "I find that the mystical thing is a bit beyond the religious," the old man was saying through an interpreter. "It's beyond personal achievement or other people. The mystical state is a feeling. Perhaps I don't consider myself very mystical, but I fall under many definitions of the mystic." He pushed his fingers through his goatee as if combing out thoughts his ancestors had planted in their own long, sparse beards. "Why do I dedicate myself to that? Why do I investigate? Why do I have my experiences? Because inside me I have my message. At the moment of conception, we receive cosmic energies. They come to where the conception is taking place. These energies are sent from every point in the universe, everywhere in space. We're all mixes of energies, codes of energies that mix together inside us. And in this way, the genetic code is formed. The body, the color of the eyes, everything that we inherit from the preceding generations. Each one of us has a mission to preserve the chain of evolution and to enrich it with our own experiences. The system is always forming different beings because the components that make it up are always in flux. The earth is always moving around the sun. The sun is moving as well. So it's impossible that any particular instant will come to be again, and it's impossible for two people to be exactly the same. In every generation, a certain number are born who are different from the rest. They are in no way superior to the others. Nothing draws your attention. They live in their own worlds. With a little effort, they earn as much money as they need. This type of person normally doesn't begin to talk at an early age, or maybe they don't pronounce words well. Sometimes they talk confusedly or in a loud voice, or so softly you can hardly hear. They live in a different world. They're mystics. Mystics are people who are outside of this world without being outside it. They like to be alone. They find places where the energies present themselves. It's not that they look for places of power. It's that their own destiny takes them there. There, they feel very calm, and they have their experiences. They don't go looking for experiences. They receive them. They have access to visions, to revelations, of things that can't be perceived by everyone. Sometimes it seems to them that someone is talking to them. They hear a voice. They say, "Ah, someone is communicating with me." Also, they begin to feel sensations in their body. They feel like hands are stroking their body when the wind blows, or they feel the caresses of the sun. It's not an idea. It's not a theory. It's really the energy of the sun. Not only the heat, but a number of different energies that come from the sun. They don't know why, but sometimes it makes them want to cry. It's something that comes to them from outside. Why does this happen? Because they're very sensitive, and they're following a process of further sensitization. At first they might feel bad. They don't know what's happening. But as the years pass, they get used to receiving messages, which become clearer and clearer. And they begin to experiment, little by little. When a communication takes place, they say, "Welcome, I want more." And so it happens that they have no more fear of death. They're not afraid of spirits or ghosts, either. They're not afraid of the unknown. They seek it out. They perceive another world. And the other world is what's beyond death. So death doesn't exist for them. After their body breaks down, they continue to exist. So this world isn't so important anymore. It's the other world that attracts them, and where they're certain to be happy. They're here because physically they've been put here, but with other senses which are beyond the five physical ones, they perceive the other world, and they can travel within it. The ceremonies in the indigenous world that we are developing are quite different from the Western world. The values are different. Money doesn't enslave us. We attract it, it comes, and we spend it. And we welcome all the perceptions that come. When you lose your fear of the unknown, when you lose your fear of death, that's when you start to really live. At least, speaking for myself, I've reached the conclusion that the world we're living in right now isn't real. It's a lie. It's only a form in our mind. Our senses perceive it because they're conditioned to perceive this universe, which is an energy that's vibrating at a special frequency. This universe doesn't exist at other wavelengths. Right now, right here, there are millions of radio waves. They're being transmitted by thousands of stations all over the world. We can turn on a radio and bring them in. The radio contains crystals, which, if they approach one another, vibrate a certain number of times per second. And if they draw apart, they vibrate at another number of times per second. For example, 900 kilocycles, and you have a whole world of sound, messages, music, etc. You move the crystals and you have another. This reminds us that we're vibrating at a wavelength which permits the existence of this moment and this space, but which has no validity in others. And there are innumerable waves, radio waves, television waves, cosmic rays, an infinite number. So you become aware that this world isn't so much, that it's not so valuable. The important thing is the experiences you have. A person who decides to be a mystic can become one, but it's going to cost a lot of suffering. We call it the path of pain. You have to suffer to dominate your appetites. You follow special diets. You close yourself off to the things of this world, the pleasures and satisfactions. You work on this from sunrise to sunset every day of your life. The mystic's mission isn't to be world famous. It's not to gain power or a lot of money. It's not to stand out. It's simply to examine all the sensations that come to you. And each one of them leads you closer to ecstasy. Ecstasy is the goal of the mystic. How do we define ecstasy? It's a marvelous state in which you feel that you become weightless. You lose all feelings of pain, anguish, fear, and you find yourself very much above all that. I want to bring myself as close as possible to the state of ecstasy. To me, it's like orgasm. Orgasm, when you feel it, lasts seconds, that's all. But with mysticism, it lasts hours. It's a beautiful thing to conserve this vibration, this wave. It's the greatest sensation that it's possible to achieve. But it's not something that happens by accident. You go out in nature. You feel something sweet in your mouth. Later you feel warm. Then a vibration picks you up and you feel that you're floating. Time doesn't exist. Nothing exists but light. It's not a light that blinds you. It's a light that embraces you, that gathers you in. An energy as soft as velvet. In these moments you perceive another way of life, another reality, in which you can see the universe in its totality. Even more, you can understand it. You can open your arms and embrace everything. You're in communication with something superior. And if you ask it, does the universe have an end? It says, yes. At least that's what I was told. I said, where does it end? It said, where time is frozen, where time is congealed, that's where the universe has its end. Once I was at a sun dance, suffering horribly, hanging from the tree, twisting around. They cut into your chest and put in pegs attached to ropes, and they pull you up to hang from the tree, and you feel your chest slowly ripping. Your blood drips down. You feel an incredible pain. It goes up to your head. You feel like your brain is on fire. You see everything in red. But you tolerate the pain because it's your sacrifice and you want to feel it. So I was hanging there in agony. I was spinning. I looked up, and with the eagle wings that I held, one in each hand, I stabilized myself in the air like an eagle flying. Then I looked right at the sun, and in that moment the sun turned blue. The pain was gone. The sensation of hanging by the skin of my chest was gone, and I felt I was flying like an eagle, and I entered ecstasy. And in the same moment, the blue sun exploded. An enormous explosion. Something said to me that the whole universe had exploded. I saw it expanding in a sphere, all the matter, going at an enormous velocity. I was in the middle, at the axis. Later it slowed down, little by little, until it stopped. There, far away, all the matter converted to energy, to light. Someone said to me, "What you're seeing is all the matter that exists in the universe. It's concentrating itself again." And I watched it, feeling this ecstasy, this beautiful vibration. In a moment, the light formed into the shape of an enormous ring, and I saw it balancing itself in space. It shone like it was all made of diamonds, and the diamonds were suns sparkling, millions and billions of suns glittering in this enormous ring of energy. A voice said to me, "This is your name." At that moment, the ecstasy left me. I felt myself falling. Suddenly, I was on all fours on the ground. My skin had broken through. I had fallen from very high up in the tree. My friends helped me stand up. That was a mystical experience. It showed me my path, and it supports me to this day. I can enter this state of ecstasy whenever I want to. I can feel the sensation, and it may last minutes or hours, as long as I want, wherever I am. Traveling on a plane, on a bus, when I'm eating, when I'm sleeping, when I'm bathing, whenever I want. It's like a prize. For me, that's mysticism. It's an experience that guided me to itself, and I can be infinitely happy whenever I want to be. All humans are capable of reaching this state of mysticism. It's not yet time for everyone to do it, but in the future, more and more mystics are going to be born, little by little, until the whole human race becomes mystical, until they become the superior beings of the future, the ones who will be capable of creating everything they're capable of imagining. Perhaps I can't make a scientific analysis of mysticism, but what I've said is my own experience. Consider it, then, as something personal. Thank you. Aho. During the question and answer session, he said he was holding a sun dance in Mexico in a few months. He invited anyone in the audience to attend if they happened to be in the area. I made plans to happen to be in the area.
I'm going to go to the hospital.